Yo. Mr. E back on the mic again with another interview. In fact, the second interview we've done today. Now we're going to slide on over to some internet radio. Next person we're going to be talking to has his own internet radio show called Media Monarchy. It's been on the air for about 5 years. James Pilato is the founder and main man and basically Mr. Everything for Media Monarchy. So how's it going there, James?
Doing well, man. Thanks for talking to me.
Yeah, well, anytime. It's free. Whatever I do is pretty much for free, and I don't really make money off anything I do, it seems. But your background is in, well, West Virginia. Mm-hmm. What was that like growing up in West Virginia? You went to a state college in West Virginia called Shepherd College, and that's where you began DJing. Yes. So tell me about growing up in West Virginia and what got you into radio in the first place.
I think growing up in West Virginia has maybe given me a great kind of foundation to then go to a city. And so, like you said, I've been in Portland for about 5 years. You know, my brother's lived in Manhattan for over a decade, and he's always said the same thing, that having those kind of, I guess it sounds folksy or homey to say, you know, those kind of small town values, rather than in like inhibit you in a city, can actually, that they really do help you. Being a nice, more or less polite, generous kind of person doesn't necessarily always get you stomped on and run over in the cities, and maybe it will, but I've always found coming from a small town in West Virginia to have been nothing but an asset. So growing up in a small town, there wasn't a whole hell of a lot going on, and the irony of it all is that, you know, I had a conservative Christian upbringing, not super strict by any sense, you know, there was no snake handling or any kind of craziness like that, but well, I wasn't allowed to go to movies and I wasn't allowed to buy music or listen to it. Now, of course, we had TV and could watch some TV, and so again, I wasn't allowed to go to see or buy or listen to whatever I wanted, but there was still media around, and it was enough to always really pique my curiosity. And you know, you discover that when my parents became born again Christians, they threw out all their records. So then once you're at that age, you're like, what, you threw out all your Beatles records? But in the church, they would always, it was a lot of sort of end times, you know, Revelations, Armageddon talk. Mm-hmm. And this being in the era of the 80s, which was then, it was the, you know, the commies are going to get us, the right. Russians are going to get us. So that was the big fear right. Then. But there was always a lot of traveling missionaries and other teachers and things that would do a lot of things about the evils of rock music. And I remember them playing Queen backwards. If you play Another One Bites the Dust backwards, it says start to smoke marijuana, and all these other Judas Priest and Ozzy and all that stuff. That to me, it was basically like, that's really cool. And not even just the, you know, any kind of devil occult aspect to it. I think just that it made me more interested in it. So of course, the great disappointment of my mom is the things she tried to keep me away from are the things that I'm now the most heavily involved with. But then it was going away to the college, which was about 5 hours away from where I was originally from and is really almost like Maryland. It's right on the border of Maryland. It's about an hour away from DC. So it was a much more, you know, it was a more affluent place. And when you have a small college town close enough to the nation's capital, it had a lot more of a cooler vibe and a lot, you know, with arts and music and bands, and it even had radio. So basically when I saw Pump Up the Volume and talk radio and things like that, and just some of the music that I heard, and we were joking earlier about, you know, those first tapes and things that I heard, whether that was the Beastie Boys or Minor Threat or the Dead Kennedys, that, you know, the tapes my brother had hidden in a shoebox under the bed. It was those kind of things, you know, that really kind of energized me. So when I got away, that sounds bad, but when I got to college, there was that whole world for me that I could then kind of build for myself. So that pretty much started with immediately getting involved with WSHC.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up Pump Up the Volume, a very excellent radio movie, pirate radio movie. Hey, have you ever seen a radio movie called Talk to Me about the DJ Petey Green in Washington, D.C. in the 70s?
I have not seen the film version, like the sort of fictional film version with Don Cheadle, but we did actually watch a PBS, you know, hour-long documentary about Petey Green. That was actually narrated by Don Cheadle. It was one of those after the fact we put it together. It was like, oh, Don Cheadle does the narration of this documentary, but he actually played Petey Green in the film Talk to Me. That was an entirely new person. I had never heard of Petey Green before until we got in this disc 6 months ago on Netflix. Wow. That's what's still always amazing about any kind of history or media or any kind of this 21st century education. That there's constantly something like Petey Green's like, I had never heard of this guy before. And to discover that, you know, what a pivotal role he played in the DC area as far as doing talk radio and even a nascent, you know, independent TV show that was pushing the boundaries and talking about race and politics.
When I saw the movie Talk to Me, I had an absolutely affirmative memory of that era when radio was huge. Because, you know, I've been doing pirate radio for some number of years now in Olympia, Washington. And whenever I'm on the air, I always hear the voices of those old jive talking DJs from the 70s playing the music off the streets and talking about reality. And that's why I do it, you know, and that era is the era where I'm from. It's a era where radio was huge. And now we live in an era where radio has kind of been dying, but the internet has brought together a whole new type of programming and media. So did you grow up with the internet and so on?
I wouldn't say that I really grew up with the internet. It was really probably my second year in college. I remember it being 97 was the point when the school offered, you have, you know, an email account. All you have to do is come to the office, and it was basically your name and some digits that basically is kind of spit out whatever your name was in mine. Yeah, it was something like J. Palat 01. You know, it wasn't even your full name. It would drop the last letter or something. And that was still, you know, now that I think about it, that was 97, and that was the, you know, the green screen kind of command-based, you know, I can't even describe, you know, that form of what the internet was at 97. It wasn't, at that point, the computers, at least in that lab, where the green screen text-based, you know, internet service. And it was some point after that that then there were some of the computer labs that I started to do more browsing. But it was really, for me, it was mostly post 9/11 that really got me kind of involved in, you know, not only using the internet but also kind of, I guess, giving back to it.
Post 9/11, you became interested in presenting conspiracy research topics on the radio. Tell us a little bit about your show, Media Monarchy, maybe something like how it started. I know you mentioned that you had put up the website in West Virginia and then came out here to Portland, Oregon and started doing the show. What kind of topics did you do in the early days of the show? What kind of programming did you do? And how has that changed and evolved over time?
I guess it has kind of had a long and slow building process because, yeah, I'm pretty much the lone person doing the website and doing the radio show. In Shepherdstown, when I was still DJing at the station, you know, and I had in addition to just doing the regular music programming for the, you know, the heavy rotation and being in contact with the record labels and sending out charts and just that kind of the radio duties, I had a show that I would do Friday nights at 11 that was sort of a free-form electronic, you know, experimental mix show where, you know, we would use, you know, a lot of times it was myself, but also my friend Kurt, who I played in a band with, and we would also kind of do live experimental electronic music. The show would kind of utilize the, you know, the turntables, the CD decks, the tape decks, the satellite feed, the inputs, anything that basically, I guess, taking a cue from the sort of like Negative Land or Emergency Broadcast Network, those kind of like, you know, they're bands, but they're really almost more like audio artists and making kind of remixes and things. So it was doing that. So I was the radio guy and the theater sound design guy and played in a band again in Shepherdstown, a sort of big fish in a small pond, if you will. But post 9/11, I started on my own to get into researching, you know, conspiracy topics. But it wasn't something that in 2002 or 3 or 4 that was really that cool to talk about. So you weren't really talking so much about 9/11 truth or 9/11 questions. For me, it was something that was still kind of relatively new. So it wasn't something I was going to go and just start running my mouth about to anybody, because I hadn't even kind of begun to grasp a lot of it. And it's a constant learning process to this day. So I was still doing the regular music and band and theater stuff, but on my own time, I was becoming more and more interested in conspiracy research. And again, you know, and we were joking earlier, I can pin it all down to my own curiosity one day, you know, in 2002, of saying, hey, what's the video of the plane hitting the Pentagon look like? And all you had to do at that point was Google that and discover we have no idea. We had never seen it. It was before they had even given us the four little frames that still show nothing.
Right.
So it was something I kind of kept to myself. So when I moved to Portland in 2005, I had set up Media Monarchy. And I think originally I was going to do it as almost like a music, you know, and culture blog. But when I got to Portland and didn't have a job, didn't really have any friends, wasn't exactly sure what the hell I was going to do out here, other than I came out here to be with the girl I loved. She moved out here, so I came about 8 months later. It was basically having the time that kind of made me realize that I wanted to really start to devote to the website. The radio show happened about a year later, actually. So the website's older than the radio show. Once I finally got work in Portland and then realized that I could have time to do, you know, the extracurricular activities, if you will, that was when I started to do the radio show and got in touch with Portland Radio Authority, and they had some open slots. It was basically got in touch. They said, yeah, and I started doing it just a couple weeks after that in October 2006.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that it influenced you, such as to do like sound collage, such as Negative Land. Did you know that Negative Land originally started on the radio, on Free Radio Berkeley?
I don't know that I knew it was Berkeley, but yeah, it was the Over the Edge series. Yeah, and that's, and you know, and I mean, they're definitely not what you would think of as any kind of typical band. I mean, they're probably basically more like professor and music nerd types.
Yeah, I just felt like I'd throw that out. So was 9/11 the main topic of your early shows? And how many shows have you done, and what have you branched out to cover as time has gone on?
It did, I guess, probably initially start out being focused on 9/11. I wouldn't say that it was, you know, a 9/11 blog, per se. I think probably some of the original postings on there were also things about HARP, and some maybe new military technology. But for me, and again, we kind of discussed a little bit about, you know, the 9/11 questions and things, that for me, to compare it to something like JFK, is that we can argue about the ballistics and those kind of things till the cows come home, but that it maybe doesn't get to the heart of what really went down and why. So that to this day, you know, we can talk about was Oswald, you know, the six shots and the Mannlicher Carcano and the ballistics and the sidewalk and James Tague and the magic bullet and all those different things. And today it's the buildings and the free fall speed and the thermite and Building 7 and all those things that I will totally say about both cases. There's compelling evidence that, of course, there were multiple shots in Dealey Plaza. And of course, the building collapses are suspicious as hell looking, especially Building 7. But it seemed like over the years, those came to be the central focus. So that when you said 9/11 truth to someone, they think, oh yeah, the buildings were blown up. That's all it's about. And right. That for me, it kind of, it keeps it in the speculative realm. Because all that stuff's gone, unfortunately. Right. Whether you're talking about the bullet that was found on the stretcher that was supposedly the magic bullet, or the steel, and all those things they're all pretty much gone. Or they're a museum piece that they say is the bullet, or they say was the rifle, or they say was the steel. it keeps it in that speculative realm, and for me it's when you get into the intelligence connections and who could actually have had the ability to pull off the cover-up, the destruction trail of the crime scene, the paper trail, and all of those things. So whether that's the insider trading or the military exercises or the stand down, so whether, I mean, I don't know if you ever saw the video of, and I think the guy's name is Ripka, Henry Ripka. There's the old footage just before the motorcade is rolling out. You see a Secret Service guy get called off of the runner on the side of the presidential limo. He's told to get off of the limo, and you see him standing there going, you know, shrugging, repeated, going like, you can see him saying, why? Why are you calling me off as the limo pulls away? So it's those kind of things for me that's like lead to more concrete, you know, that it's ideally people that have addresses and names that could be prosecuted.
Very interesting. So what kind of topics do you cover on Media Monarchy show nowadays? And how many shows have you done, James?
That's right. You did ask me that. When I started to do the show, I would do a weekly two-hour show on praradio.org. As the show went on, and I guess I got a little better at it and figuring out the site and what I could go over in 2 hours or not, and then maybe started to do a couple of interviews here and there. And I think it was really once the presidential campaign and all of that started to kick in 07. So whether that was, you know, getting involved and even being excited by, you know, the ideas and the candidacy of people like Ron Paul, that was, I think, when the show really started to kind of take on and get even larger and larger, that it was, you know, I couldn't cover the news by any stretch on just a two-hour spot. So I started to then record shows at home that I'll refer to as B-sides. And I think, again, that's something I'd like to use media references and names. So, you know, the B-side, that's the flip side of, you know, a single. So I use it as the B-side to the regular episodes to give you that extra information. My show that I did yesterday was episode 170. So even though that's 170, that doesn't now take into account, I don't know how many B-sides that I've done and interview episodes, and have started in the last year to do a video series with James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and even putting together what I call mixtapes that are basically, again, just new and old music that I like. Still, I think, trying to constantly pull on my background in radio programming, that in a way where it's like, well, it can't all be horrible news and conspiracies all the time. I still like movies and music. And so I think it, for me, kind of uses more of my interests and personality, and I think it also makes for a more interesting show for people to follow, because maybe each week or even each day they don't know what's going to show up, you know, in their download folder of something new that I've put up. Does that answer your question?
Yes, I will accept that as an answer to my question. We also have with us here Conspirazine radio host Demi DeAssis, who's a conspiracy research superstar of the Northwest. And what I was wondering was if Demi DeAssis, if you'd like to ask James' take on different contemporary conspiracy research topics. I'm curious to hear about your viewpoints, and so I'm going to hand you over to an expert here.
Yeah, I've noticed listening to some of your shows, which we rebroadcast on Free Radio Olympia, usually in the mornings, try to get it on as early as possible. Anyway, I noticed that you have some subject matter on biowars and vaccines and stuff like that, which is of profound interest to me, too. And just wanted to let you know, at the conspiracy conference coming up in June, there's going to be several doctors talking about that subject of, you know, biological weapons and stuff. There's Dr. Len Horowitz and Dr. William Deagle and one other doctor. But anyway, can you kind of elaborate as to why you've been really kind of talking a lot about that and bringing out a lot of, I think, crucial information on the subject matter?
Well, and then that just made me realize you asked me what topics do I cover on the show that I didn't mention. I think that's something that I feel, and it you know, and again, I come to this in the post 9/11 internet era. Yes, there's been conspiracy research, you know, in decades prior, you know, even, you know, the buildup probably a lot of in the 90s, just with, as the, you know, whether that was the Trilateral Commission and NAFTA and, you know, Clinton and drug running and all of those things and Oklahoma City and Waco and all those things started to come, that I'm, you know, of the post 9/11 internet era, that I feel like one of the most positive things about, you know, 9/11, if you call it the 9/11 truth movement, is that it's, in a way, has kind of just spawned a general kind of truth movement. So you have people that are focused on the vaccine issue or the GMO food issue or, you know, the police state at home issue, and whether that's, you know, the military weapons or the, you know, federalization of the police force and, you know, the loss of posse comitatus and all those things, that in a way, and that's what we were saying, it's like, I can't, there's no way I could just do a 9/11 show, because I could just do a 9/11 show every week in addition to just doing a vaccine, you know, environment and health related show. And that's maybe what, like I say, it seems positive, but that there are a lot of groups that have those, you know, those focus. But that it, in a other way, kind of shows kind of how dire I think things have gotten, that we feel in a way that we're kind of, we're under attack on so many levels. So whether that is the food or the war or privacy or any of those, surveillance or any of those things, it's like everywhere you turn, it's, things are definitely kind of escalating. And I think that's why I feel compelled on the show to not necessarily just focus on one thing, but to try and give folks, you know, just a massive kind of overview data dump and say, you know, here it all is. I've posted it all up. I've made copies of all of it.
Right.
I'm going to present it to you in hopefully understandable and even entertaining format that hopefully you can then hand off to someone else and go, hey, yeah, what was that thing you mentioned on the show? I'm going to go look more into that.
Right.
And so that's, I think, for me, the kind of trying to kind of lay out a path for folks. And it's for myself, too. Again, I always say it's like, I ain't the smartest guy in the world. Right. I just am observant. And I like talking to people about information.
And it seems like there are a lot of people sort of outside the conspiracy realm who, when they hear about this type of stuff, kind of stereotype you, thinking that, oh, you know, you're into this morbid stuff, so you must be either paranoid or delusional and you don't have any hope. But to be quite honest, I'm a very hopeful type of person. And I think part of it for me is to disseminate the information, to educate people, to show them that, hey, this is a possibility of what's going on, and to kind of have people think for themselves for a change, just because we've been so bombarded through, you know, the corporate media and then through the public school system and through other sources to, you know, think for us instead of us being able to think for ourselves. So anyway, can you maybe kind of elaborate on how you kind of break through that stereotype?
I think in a way there's a lot of the things that I'm personally interested in. You know, I love to look into synchronicities in media and what, you know, people refer to as predictive programming, whether that's, you know, shows and films and TV, you know, whatever other kind of media kind of seeming to predict events that then happen in real life. So whether that's, you know, the first Lone Gunman episode of, you know, that series that showed, you know, 6 months prior to 9/11 showing hijacked jets by remote control to crash into the World Trade Center to start the clash of civilizations. 6 months later, this exact same thing happens. And then you start to look into some of the strange connections of maybe Chris Carter and CIA connections. And and actually, the X-Files have their, or the actual X-Files have their origin in the Pacific Northwest. But it's some of those things that I find really interesting. And again, whether that's occult symbology and corporate, you know, symbolism, those kind of things, I find extremely interesting.
Right.
But I may not talk about them or post them up on the website or the show very much. Because for me, it's like you said, you get dismissed out of hand. Even, you know, we've used the word conspiracy, you know, and we use it for conferences because it's an unfortunate it's the best shorthand to describe the subject matter, but it's almost the double-edged sword that keeps us in the realm of, oh, well, if you say conspiracy, that means you think the moon landing was fake and right. Bigfoot and that kind of stuff. So that's what's tough for me, whether it's shows or outlets. And again, I try not to attack any other researchers or hosts or amateur historians or any of that. But when you mix in, whether you're talking about UFOs and chupacabras, but then turn around and say about, you know, executive orders or, you know, NORTHCOM having combat troops on American soil. Basically what I'm saying, when you talk about things that are speculative and then switch to talk about things that are absolutely documented and happening right now, it mixes it all up in this swirl that makes it easy for people to go, yeah, the military's here, yeah, Bigfoot, right. And it's all just kind of coast-to-coast entertainment. So I guess for me it almost feels like the stakes are much higher now, that things do really seem to be escalating to something. Do I expect to see stormtroopers marching down the street tomorrow? You know, no. Could that happen? Absolutely. But it seems like we're kind of on the, you know, the frog boil, slowly turning up the water. And before we know it, we're going to be in the control grid, if we aren't already, you know, inextricably in it, you know, to begin with. But then, of course, we do have these kind of what they call catalyzing catastrophic events that do really escalate and accelerate, you know, this agenda from, again, things that we can prove that folks like the Rockefellers and these families and organizations and the Rothschilds and, you know, Richard Grove of tragedyandhope.com coined, I think, and I use it all the time, so think of them as multi-generational serial killers. And they're these families. Yeah. And they've been called Illuminati in the past, and there are definitely bloodlines that you can see that a lot of these people are all connected. And these are all things that are completely provable. But for folks, as soon as they hear, you know, the other day somebody, and I basically use my Facebook page as just a way to put out news and information from the website. Sure, it connects me up to people I went to high school with and those kind of things, but I feel like for the most part, you know, I like to be in touch with some of those folks, but for the people that I really know and love and who know and love me, I don't need Facebook to be in touch with them. So in a way, I use it as another platform to just try and get out the information. And if it's the most popular, you know, place right now, and 2 years ago it was MySpace, I think we need to go there and basically give information there. So what I'm saying is, the other day somebody was like, to some story of mine that got posted up, and I don't even recall what it is now, that they were like, you know, oh, well, what isn't a conspiracy? Saying, you know, oh, so everything is a conspiracy, you know, and all I can say is like, no, it's everything, it's all just a huge coincidence. And that, you know, for me is, so whether we're talking about the ballistics of JFK or the buildings on 9/11, we can't prove some of that stuff, but all these other things we absolutely can, but people want to dismiss all of it out of hand and keep it in the realm of just kind of entertainment. And that's something that, you know, I like the name Media Monarchy, that I think that's kind of what the show feels like, that it's a huge overview of internet, television, pirate radio, books, interview, you know, all those things put together for folks. That shows, obviously, you know, that we watch these things in movies all the time, but somehow think that they could never happen in real life. So, I mean, one has to definitely inform the other. And again, when you start to look at who owns the corporations, and again, you find all the same players and all the same families, and when you see the biggest directors, so whether that's, you know, Ridley Scott or Tony Scott or Michael Bay or these guys that work directly with the military on their films, and those are the ones that are just really ham-fisted and obvious. You know, it's no mystery that they're working with the Pentagon to make sure they have the coolest looking shit for Transformers or whatever. But it's all the other kind of more buried connections that you have to kind of discover through things that starts to show that, well, there's obviously something there. There's obviously these ideas and memes being put out in the media on purpose that at a younger age, I would think when I heard, you know, subversive media or music, and would think, wow, this is on, you know, Warner Brothers. I can't believe they got away with that. Right. That I, it was only when I got older was that I realized, it was like, well, one, they didn't get away with it.
Right.
These things are all completely vetted and looked at. And ultimately, they're a corporation, and they're going to do whatever they think makes them money. So whether that's something, some radical politics, or a sweeping Celine Dion ballad, either way, they know which way the wind's blowing, and they're going to make money off of it. But it's also interesting to think that it's, again, you know, places like Warner Brothers or News Corp that put out these ostensibly subversive pieces of media. Something like V for Vendetta I always found kind of interesting. That it's basically trying to tell people to get violent. And I think ultimately with
Fight
all
Club.
The... And Fight Club, which is, you know, still a fantastic film.
Right.
But ultimately, it's not like it was some indie, you know, guerrilla operation that got slipped into the mainstream.
Right.
It's like, these are major, major operations. And these are these ideas showing you, you know, that, oh, maybe violent, you know, revolt is the way to go, that I ultimately feel like, you know, that's the end. That the moment we go violent is when we'll lose, and that will give the Northcom troops that are already positioned here the excuse to go at it.
So, James, tell me about the videos you've been putting together. And you're putting together videos. I'm going to assume you're probably using something like Final Cut or something, editing software, streaming on this stuff on the internet, you're making flash videos and so on. Tell me about your video productions and what's been going on.
The videos are something that are relatively new that I started with, again, and I believe I already mentioned, James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, who's actually a Canadian citizen who's been in Japan for the last several years. He started his website and weekly podcast, I think probably a year maybe after I had started. And at some point in the last couple of years, you know, I literally just shot him an email that was like, hey, man, I started listening to your show and I like it. And that was probably how the, you know, the collaboration, or at least, you know, the online friendship started. But it was something probably last October, and he and I had started to kind of get together more and trying to figure out maybe something that we could collaborate on, that we started this weekly video series called, and we called it The New World Next Week, which I think I coined. And it's actually, and we don't really, you know, we don't really point a finger to this. It's one of those things that if folks figure it out, that's fine. It's a play on a Council on Foreign Relations podcast. They have a weekly podcast called The World Next Week. And so we started this video, and kept it to 10 minutes. Kept it to where, you know, we could upload it to YouTube. And, you know, for the most part, your videos have to be under 10 minutes. So we called it The New World Next Week, and I kind of photoshopped a sort of parody of the logo of that podcast. So again, if you go, you know, and go check out The New World Next Week on youtube.com/CorbettReport, you'll see the logo is kind of a parody of this Council on Foreign Relations podcast, which of course I shouldn't probably, or don't have to tell folks what the CFR is, or, you know, just another one of those organizations a little higher up the pyramid who kind of have, they take their talking and, you know, walking orders from, you know, the higher up organizations, whether that's Bilderberg or Trilateral or Committee of 300 or Club of Rome or any of those kind of roundtable secret societies. CFR, you know, then those are the folks that are in our media and in our schools and all over the place, that then it really starts to filters down and it really gets into what's referred to as mockingbird media. So, aside from a brief history of the Council on Foreign Relations, the videos, actually, I couldn't be more fortunate with the way that they go. James Corbett actually captures the video. So we basically use Skype and have a conversation. We'll have coordinated maybe once before, you know, we shoot it each week to say, you know, what stories do we want to go over? And we try and keep it to, you know, three stories in 10 minutes. You know, can basically give us, you know, 3 minutes for each story and 30 seconds to get in and out. But, so we use Skype to do the conversation. We, you know, sort of time it to where hopefully there's not a whole lot of post-production that needs to be done, that we basically shoot it in real time, and hopefully that's, you know, and that's the version that goes up. But James, I mean, hats off to him. He does all that video editing. All I basically have to do is be at my computer Wednesdays at 1 o'clock when we shoot it and have the stories that I want to go over. I mean, it's really, again, and that's why I'm so thankful for it. It's basically a platform for Media Monarchy to cover stories that are either on Media Monarchy or some of the other sites I started in the last year to cover, like we said, all these other different areas. I started foodworldorder.com and cyberspacewar.com to cover just, you know, those areas. So really, Corbett Report has given Media Monarchy the platform to discuss things that are on those websites. And again, like I said, he captures it all. He edits all of it and puts it together. He gets, you know, he gets up at 6 in the morning because he's in Japan.
There you go. Hammerhead.
Okay. Can I have a beat? Sure. That was us ordering another round.
it's
real life. You can leave that in or edit it out. But it's, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, 1 or 2 in the afternoon to me, but it's literally 6 in the morning in Japan. So he gets up and does it before, you know, he goes off and does his regular job. So I, you know, I've always done radio, and I'm good, I think, at audio editing. And I've done a bit of video editing, but it's a lot more labor intensive, and it's, you know, I'd like to do more of it, but for me it's one of those, you can do audio on just about any basic computer setup, but to do any kind of quality video, you need not only the gear to kind of be able to handle it, but you also then need even that much more, you know, know-how and smarts. So again, the New World Next Week, I, you know, give huge thanks to James Corbett for making that happen. Like I said, I basically just have to show up and be able to present. He is actually, I think, he's been on a little bit of a hiatus for the last couple weeks, so we haven't actually done a New World Next Week for a couple of weeks. In the meantime, and it's just, it's all coincidentally, I discovered and just had heard about a site called Ustream.tv. And I started to use that to actually stream live video of my live broadcast, so that if someone goes while I'm doing my show live, if they go to ustream.tv/mediamonarchy, they will see a webcam stream of myself doing the show, which I'll be the first to admit isn't the most fascinating thing to look at. But it's another way, I think, to kind of branch out and get this information out. And it's a way for me to kind of learn, you know, some of these new sites. And again, it's what's, I think, really exciting seemingly about Ustream is that there's not a lot of people on there yet. Like, it doesn't really seem like it's taken off. But to me, that kind of platform and technology is something that's it's awesome. And so I've liked getting on there in the last couple weeks, and I've been broadcasting live video. And it also has a setting to where you can be streaming live video, and then there's a secondary button that'll say record a video. Wow. And you don't have to stop and switch out of one to do the other. So the last couple of weeks, while I haven't been doing the New World Next Week, I've been capturing live video from doing my live show on Portland Radio Authority. So those have been going up to my YouTube channel lately. And again, they're very rudimentary. I've struggled to even get enough lighting in our little studio to make it even something to look at. But I basically, all I had to do was kind of turn myself 45 degrees to get we have a big Portland Radio Authority banner in the studio. So I kind of reoriented myself to where this banner's in the background, and I still generally do the show just as I'd been doing, but basically added a video overlay, which again, I'll admit, has made it more difficult that it's, again, being a one-man show. I'm producing it, running the board, running the clips, editing all that stuff and setting it up, trying to keep a coherent train of thought, and meanwhile still watching the timer and watching my levels and doing all that stuff. So I love it, and I think it, again, all kind of speaks to why I think the name Media Monarchy is so fitting. And I have to say, my girlfriend coined that term, media monarchy.
Oh, wow.
Well before it was going to be the name of my, you know, conspiracy site and show. It was right. Just, we were always throwing around, like, cool band names or any of that kind of stuff. So that's actually where the name came from.
Quite a catchy name. I like it a lot. So I guess I'll assume that you aren't stripping in front of the webcam to attract new listeners.
No, not yet anyway. It hasn't gotten that bad yet.
Interject moment of humor. Okay, Demi Desius would like to make a comment.
I think I first heard about your show a little over a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, through DJ Shock and Awe. You know, he was like plugging in on Google searches, you know, conspiracy radio shows, and it came up with the Visigoth show, and then Adam Gorightly's Untamed Dimensions, and then Media Monarchy. So it's like I created a monster with DJ Shock and Awe, and he started putting in, you know, queuing up all these conspiracy shows. But you know, once I heard James's show, sounded pretty coherent and I could understand it, and it seemed like it was pretty non-biased, straight to the point, and I'd have to say it's probably my favorite radio show on the internet right now.
Sound of the stadium erupting in applause. Media Monarchy, yeah! So, yeah, Mr. James Pilato, you know, I really have enjoyed meeting you today, sir.
Absolutely.
I think what I'll be doing here is passing the microphone around, and we'll kind of make some closing commentaries, and then we'll wrap things up and finish drinking our happy hour beers and proceed from there. So I'm going to pass the mic around. First, I'm going to pass it to Demi Desius, and then you, James Pilato. And then back to myself, Mr. E, and then we'll call it a day for this interview. But I will hope that we will meet up again sometime and maybe even create talking points next time for some more extended conversations. So here, I'm going to pass the mic to Demi Desius. Here you go, Demi.
Sorry, I got some amber ale down the wrong windpipe there. But anyway, it was a pleasure meeting you, James. And like I said, I've been listening to your show for about a year and a half now, and we stream it regularly on Saturday mornings on Free Radio Olympia at 98.5 FM, and can also be heard via the internet MP3 stream at www.froolympia.com. So hey, and if you want to go down to the conspiracy conference with me in a few weeks, you're more than welcome to jump on board.
And I'm seriously considering that. And you just kind of mentioned, you know, some of the other, you know, shows that will get played. Mm-hmm. That kind of reminds me of when I was still at WSHC. And again, I started out being just a DJ there when I was 18 years old, and I was at the point where I more or less had to play what was in the heavy rotation box. You know, I could pick whatever was in there and could, you know, play it. But, you know, flash forward 10 years after that, when I was still at the station, and literally had the keys to the place. I'd gotten the point to where I had a key actually to the English building, so I could go key in at 3 in the morning if I wanted to, and did often. It was my kind of sanctuary, it was my getaway, it was my office, it was my canvas. But I would, and again, it was this sort of almost like as this sort of double life in a way started to emerge between being the you know, the music and theater guy, but meanwhile also being more and more and more interested in, you know, alternative news and politics and conspiracies. I would, you know, and I was already downloading a lot of shows and starting to find some streams. I was basically, and we had talked earlier about when I worked at the station, one of the things I worked on was doing some automation, which let us not eliminate live DJs, but let us go overnight, whereas before we were never able to do that on campus. I would go in and program. I would take the audio off of Alex Jones documentaries or other documentaries, take the audio off of those, take interviews from Black Op Radio, and I would plug those into where they would play in the middle of the night on WSHC. That in a way was sort of like I could get away with it because it wasn't me at 3 in the afternoon saying, hey, let's listen to the audio from, you know, 9/11 Road to Tyranny. It was like I could sort of plant it in there, uh-huh, and it'll run at 3:30 in the morning, and people are definitely going to hear it at that point. For the most part, it went over, I think, really well. There was a few, you know, kind of angry calls that the station got, you know, and the station manager later would be like, I don't know what you were playing last night, but it, you know, pissed a couple people off. But it was not in a position to where it was like, stop doing that. Because again, I made sure that they were clean for broadcast, because we still had to, you know, we were a non-commercial station, but we were still basically under Shepherd FCC. University. We were still under FCC rules, and we were a licensed station, so we had to abide by those rules. But I would, yeah, I started to play, you know, Black Op Radio and the audio from, I can't even remember what some of the documentaries would have been. But yeah, it was in a way like, it was my first starting to branch out and trying to put this information back out to other folks. Even as I was still trying to, you know, wrap my head around it, this free forum radio show that I mentioned earlier, that we would use a lot of, you know, source material to make a kind of electronic, you know, improv show, I started to use more, you know, conspiracy samples in that show as well, even almost subliminally in this kind of sound collage. So it was basically something from 2000 to 2005 that I was researching and just starting to kind of put out there. But I guess moving to Portland and kind of starting anew let me put the news and politics on the front burner and put some of the other, you know, theatrical things or those kind of things on the back burner. And that, you know, I think has kept it fascinating and interesting and educational for me. And I think having the, you know, the radio production and the theatrical sound design background helps make the show sound like what it does and what I think, you know, hopefully makes for a, you know, an interesting listen for folks. And I think also just looking at all the other, you know, folks of note in, you know, the conspiracy world or alternative news or, you know, internet journalism, that some of the folks that seemed a lot more polarizing and were a lot more apt to turn people off, so whether that's, you know, Alex Jones or whoever,
right,
not trying to come at it from a really argumentative way, right, or I have all the answers or the sensational thing and here's the latest thing this week that's sure to kill us all, even though it seems like there are those things. But I think trying to figure out a way to present it in a way that isn't off-putting to people. And I've also never been really one to want to stand on the corner and yell about, you know, the end is near or 9/11 was an inside job.
Right.
I've had, I think, a lot more success just with one-on-one conversations with people that either, you know, your friends and family or coworkers or even people you may meet while you're at work. I find that a far more effective way to kind of talk about these topics with folks instead of being combative about it, which is immediately going to turn people off. I work in a grocery store, and so that gives me the opportunity to sometimes to be able to mention, hey, do you know the story about Fanta, you know, soda? To be able to mention to people that, oh yeah, Fanta was started because Coke wasn't able to actually do business with the Nazis, but that was their drink that they created to still be able to kind of carry on and still have sugary water because Coke couldn't get their real ingredients there. It was the kind of shitty leftover ingredients. So it was like the Nazi Coke. And when you tell people that, Nazi, you know, they think it's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah.
But I've had, it's those kind of things that then later on that person comes back and says, man, I looked that up and yeah.
Right.
So it's for me being able to kind of plant those little truth bombs with folks and again tailoring it maybe to what I may know that they're more interested in. So whether that's economics for somebody or health and vaccines for somebody else, figuring out on a more personal basis how to get this information across, because ultimately, you know, is media monarchy gonna end the war in Afghanistan? No. Is it gonna, you know, change the world and do all these things? Probably not. But in its own way, if I can get information to folks that I have found empowering, that's ultimately the thing about, you know, being, I think, being the change you want to see in the world, in that we can affect change just on a lot of ways, but just by saying no. So that's, I guess, my way to kind of wrap it up.
Thank you, Mr. James Pilato. You know, you're talking about standing and yelling about 9/11 truth on a street corner, and I understand your point there, but interestingly, I always felt like in the U.S. we would really be benefited by having something like a Hyde Park, London and Hyde Park. You know, they have a little podium there, and people can step up on the soapbox and make their presentation. Mm-hmm. I always felt like in Olympia, where Demi Diocese and I live, yeah, that was my suggestion years ago, that I would tell to anyone who wouldn't run away from me too fast, that we should have a Sylvester Park, Hyde Park-style podium. And I suggested, like, the Sylvester Park rapper with the Master Blaster mini DJ and a backpack on his back, you know, kind of a rapper making a presentation about maybe conspiracy research ideas or something. But I still, all jokes aside, I have felt that we could use something like a Hyde Park here in the U.S., and that's been a problem that I've felt with some of these modern, more controversial topics, is that we don't really have a forum here. Like, okay, let's say in England, you know, we have, okay, here, let me give an example. We have, for instance, in terms of modern topics that are contentious, global warming. It's at least, that is what exactly is happening in terms of global climate change is one point of contention. How accurate are computer models, which are the basis for modern climate science, is another point of contention. A third one, what are the causes? Is it anthropogenic global warming or is it natural causes? At any rate, in Channel 4 in England, you know, and that's kind of the alternative to BBC, they had a debate, two-part debate series of a pro-anthropogenic global warming, pro-AGW viewpoint, and then anti-AGW viewpoint. And they would take turns. Like in one of the debates, they had a writer or someone more from the entertainment field, but with a science background, presenting a pro-AGW viewpoint, and then a scientist presenting an anti-AGW viewpoint. Next time they flipped it around, opposite. So that each time they would have someone who's dynamic and able to speak very clearly to the masses, and then someone else who's coming from a very technical view to kind of just bring it into the public sector. And I feel like that's something that I don't like so much about the media here in the U.S. is that these kind of public forums and debates don't really get held often enough. That's just my opinion, but I that's how I feel. How do you feel about that, James?
No, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's very little of what passes for a real debate in the States. So all we basically get is you can either go on the, you know, multinational corporation news outlet that's supposedly conservative, where you'll be yelled at or told to shut up by some blustery host, or you can go on the other one that's supposedly more progressive that's owned by General Electric, and they're going to...
Dialectics.
It's the dialectics. And that's actually what's been really fascinating for me to really see. Because, again, you know, we had 8 years of George Bush, and before that was, you know, 8 years of Clinton. To really see it now firsthand, having been, you know, fairly awakened and observant and kind of astute and kind of being able to see, because this was something I talked about on the show during the presidential campaign. It was like, now watch, when the Democrats come back in, you're going to see this switch on a couple different levels.
Yeah.
And to just see it happen so quickly, and see it happen in exactly the way that I thought it was going to happen. That one, it seems like when we have Democrats in office, we have what's called homegrown terrorism now.
Yeah.
So whether that's Clinton and Waco and Oklahoma City,
right,
or Obama and Times Square bomber and, you know, just the militias, and it's right back to the same 90s militia thing.
Yeah.
But when you have a supposed conservative president, the enemy's over there somewhere, and you got to go back to Iraq again. And to just see it flip back and forth so quickly, and to now see the same, you know, kind of parties and mainline organizations that were so good at exposing the frauds and the egregious power grabs and all the unconstitutional things of the Bush administration, now that their guy's in, and all those things all still continue, except for maybe just a couple cosmetic changes, the agenda still rolls forward. They all now suddenly blind to it, but now you have the other side that's now energized, and all the things that they just somehow couldn't see when their guy was in power, they can now easily see that now when Obama's doing it. So now you have people like Rush and Michael Savage and all these mainline blowhards talking about false flag terror and was this oil rig an inside job. It's like, oh, so now you can suddenly see these things because it's still in your dialectic and it's still in your little political playbook. But ultimately, whether you're talking about the two parties or you're talking about gangsters, they'll knock each other off every now and then, but they're never going to do anything that jeopardizes their game board.
Right.
They're not going to knock the game board, you know, off the table. And so I guess as far as, you know, debate, we see very little debate. And even a lot of things online, and I, for the most part, stay away from, you know, the message boards and the comment sections. It's like, if I want to depress myself, I'll go look at message boards and comments, just because it's like, with all this information and all these things now, we're still just calling each other names and not really getting a lot of, you know, a lot across. What the full answer to that is, I can't exactly say, but I know it's just not where I'm at.
All right. Now, on that note, I feel like we can end this interview. So thanks for being here today, James Pilato, founder and main man and kind of he's kind of like a one-man band who does the Media Monarchy radio show that has a video streaming component and very interesting stuff. I really like your show. I've heard it on Free Radio Olympia. I only learned about it some months ago when Demi DeAssis told me about it. But it's fascinating to hear that you've been doing this down in Portland for the past 5 years, not too far down the highway from us. So that's really awesome. Thanks. I hope we meet up again sometime. And thank you, Demi DeAssis, for suggesting coming down to Portland on this road trip and doing a couple of interviews. They're both excellent, and I'm really having a fun time here. So thank you also, and thank you for buying me beer.
Oh, no problem.
That's also appreciated. So, on that note, this is Mr. E once again saying over and out.